This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Richard C. Lewontin, who is the Alexander Agassiz Research Professor at Harvard University. An evolutionary geneticist and social critic, his publications include Human Diversity and most recently The Triple Helix, Gene, Organism, and Environment. He is visiting the Berkeley campus to deliver the Charles M. and Martha Hitchcock lectures on the campus. Welcome to Berkeley.
Thank you very much, Harry.
What drew you into the sciences?
A charismatic high school teacher. I was a student at a public high school in New York, a new public high school that catered to a primarily middle-class suburban community. And we had there a science teacher who people idolized. And he drew a number of people, a lot of people into science, a number of people who teach here and so on. And in fact, the group of his former students is now putting together a kind of collected remembrance and textbook on how to be a charismatic science teacher.
And looking back, who now we're moving from high school into your academic career, who were your main intellectual, was there any particular intellectual mentor that stands out? And
well, mentor doesn't do the job so well.
What is
as
the better word?
Opponent.
Okay. Adversary. Who is your best science
my, my professor who supervised my PhD, again, supervised not the right word, he was my professor for PhD, was the leading evolutionary geneticist of the time, Theodosius Dobzhansky. Again, a very charismatic person with a thick accent and a very lively way of dealing with people. And he and I spent the 3 years of my PhD fighting with each other about everything. And he liked that, and I liked it. So
does that tell us something about scientists and how great work gets done? It's through the fights?
Well, I didn't say great work was done. I just said well, no, that doesn't tell us much, because, in fact, most professors who have a lot of students don't like to fight with them. But some do, and I think he liked it a lot, although he would make fun of it. But conflict and struggle is very common in academic life, especially between professionals. Everybody is crazy except you, of course.
Now, you are an evolutionary geneticist, and most people in our audience probably wouldn't know what that is. What is it? What do
well,
you do?
Well, Harry, the process of evolution requires three things. It requires that there be differences among individuals within a species. In various characteristics, that those differences be inherited in some way, because otherwise every generation would go back to where things started from, and then requires some differential rate of reproduction of the different kinds. Now, the evolutionary geneticist is the person who devotes him or herself to the actual mechanics of the changes in the frequencies of different kinds of genetic properties. So why is it, for example, that all human populations have blood groups A, B, and A, B, and O? Why isn't everybody A? Or why isn't everybody B? So the explanation of the genetic variation, of how that changes in time, of how natural selection changes it. We are, if you want to put it crudely, the auto mechanics of evolutionary biology. We try to work with the machinery and how it actually operates at the genetic level.
Now, in the introduction to you at your Hitchcock lecture, it was said that you introduced the study of molecular population genetics over two decades ago. So what is involved in sort of being present at the creation?
God, it's four decades ago.
Four decades ago.
They said two, but it's four. Okay. It was 1966.
Well, we try to cover up how old we're all getting.
Yeah, well, I'm afraid I am old, and that's the... Well, the problem when I was a graduate student, and for many years before that, was that nobody knew. You wanted to be an evolutionary geneticist, then you had to be able to talk about genes. But nobody knew how to detect whether a particular gene was variable or constant in a population, because nobody had to identify individual genes. Nobody's ever found the genes for skin color, for example, or the genes for height or for weight or in people or any other organism. So for years, people worried about how is it possible for us to count up the number of individuals who have that form of the gene as opposed to that form if we can't work with the genes. Mm-hmm. This is before DNA.
Mm-hmm.
And I worried about that a lot when I was a graduate student and for a few years after that. And I constructed in my head the kind of scheme you would have to do that. But I didn't know how to do it. And then one day I went and visited the University of Chicago, and there was a guy there, Jack Hubby, who was grinding up fruit flies and extracting their proteins, and every one of those proteins corresponded to the coding product of one gene. And then if two species had a different gene form, the proteins would move slightly differently in an electric field. And I thought, this is the answer to my problem. So I moved to the University of Chicago, and here was Jack with a technique, but no particular problem to apply it to. Mm-hmm. Here was me with a problem with no technique. And so we merged together and applied his technique to the problem of measuring genetic variation and diversity in populations. And the beauty of that technique was you could do it with any kind of organism, plants, animals, people. If they were little animals, you'd grind, like insects, you'd grind them up. If they were bigger animals, you'd take some blood. If they were people, you'd take some blood. You could then characterize at the genetic level the genetic variation in any species in the world. Mm-hmm. And that's what we did. And that's really what started molecular studies of genetic variation and evolution. And then later on, Martin Kreitman, who was a graduate student in our lab in Harvard, moved that from the protein level to the DNA level. Mm-hmm. And he did the same thing at the DNA level that we had done at the protein level.
Mm-hmm. So does that experience tell us anything about creativity in the sciences? I mean, it tells us that
not enough credit is given to the effect of talking to other people and dealing with other people. There's too much emphasis on the great creative act of the great mind, mm-hmm. and it's not like that.
Mm-hmm.
I repeat, here I was with a problem looking for a solution. Here a guy was with a solution looking for a problem,
mm-hmm.
and we got together.
Mm-hmm.
Many of the things we did in our lab in Chicago arose in the course of a conversation with somebody who came in. We would have weekly talks at lunch. People would come from all over the world, happened to be in town, would come and give a talk about what they did. And we'd have a big conversation among the graduate students and the postdoctoral fellows and me and other people. And in the course of that, someone would say something that would trigger mm-hmm. an idea, and someone would go off and do it.
Mm-hmm.
And the graduate students and postdoctoral fellows and visitors and I and other all contributed to that in a way that is impossible for me in retrospect to disentangle. I can't tell you who got the idea for that mm-hmm. and who got the idea for that. Mm-hmm. So the ideas are out there. And social interaction is really important in science, I think.
And you're suggesting the importance of the community of scientists as opposed to...
I really mean community. I just mean I don't mean the collection of scientists because scientists as a whole don't form a community.
Yeah.
I mean, when we moved to Chicago from Harvard, I came with four graduate students. I think that was it, four graduate students. And we had the opportunity to design our own space because it was a new building. We were given a whole floor in that building. And so we designed the space in such a way that everybody's office opened out into a central room where there was a big table and blackboards and computers, and the labs were down the hall. You couldn't go to your office without actually walking through the laboratory, not just past it, but mm-hmm. through it. Mm-hmm. There were no doors. Your office had a door, but everybody had a key to it. And people spent a lot of time sitting mm-hmm. in that space shooting the bull.
Mm-hmm.
Or in the lab, they were facing each other. Nobody had this private space, and that included me. And the consequence is that we had a very active community of people, and eventually the thing grew within a few years to 25 people, which went on for 30 years. And everybody participated.
Mm-hmm.
It was a real community. And now I want to say something scientific political.
Okay, please.
And that is... that an important part of that sense of community was the, I hope, I believe it's true, the feeling that the professor did not have property rights over the work of the professor's students. I never in my life put my name on a paper which I didn't actually work on, I mean in the lab or computer analysis or something like that. I just thought that was wrong. Now, some people think it's a great thing because it helps the student, because it brings the student's paper to the attention of other people because a well-known person's name on it. I think that's nonsense. What it really is property rights. You can say, well, I've published 573 papers, but you're, of course, the last author on the paper, and you didn't do anything. It's taking credit for other people's work. And I think the community worked because people knew that whatever they did, they would get credit for.
Which opens up another line of inquiry that I want to get into before we talk about the whole question of the public's consciousness of science and the politics of science. And that is, you're known as, and have been for quite a while, a social critic, a commentator on science, somebody who's also been an activist. When you were at Chicago, you were involved then in a lot of the protests and so on. What is it about that? How did you come to that role? Let me ask you first of all, and then how does it relate to your role as a scientist?
Well, how do I come to it? I'm not sure I know the answer to that question. I mean, I was politically active as a student, as an undergraduate at Harvard. My father warned me not to get into political issues because it wouldn't be good for me, but I didn't pay attention to him, and I got involved to a certain extent. When I was a professor at Rochester, my wife and I and Bob Fogel, the economist, and his wife sat in a police station because of the first incidents of police brutality against black people. And I mean, it just, that was the way our lives went. When my wife and I were in school together, we were in high school together, we were part of an organized political group that the students organized called The World We Want. You know, and I mean, that was just part of life. I can't put it any more clearly than that.
So then, how has that consciousness, you know, informed your role as a scientist? Has it?
Well, sure, it has. In fact, my wife was just saying to me yesterday, I was talking with a colleague about some work I was doing on ants and ant behavior, and the woman came up from Stanford to talk to me about it. And when my colleague left, Mary Jane said to me, why do you really want to do that? I mean, why does anybody want to study the behavior of ants? What's it got to do with anything that we care about? And we started to talk about that issue, which is, what is the motivation for academic life in general? And a great deal of what I do is pretty academic, if I may put it that way. The fact of the matter is that as academics, we are supported by society in a pretty nice way. We have security and so on. The claim is that intellectual life has a value of its own, but my development has been such as to believe that what you do, I mean, sure, you have to make a living, but to make a claim on the public purse, to make a claim on the resources of society, you have to do more than say, I just want to satisfy my intellectual curiosity. I mean, that's a kind of mental masturbation that is not self-justifying, as far as I'm concerned. So you have to do political things if you're, at least I have to do political things. And then there's a question of the relationship. So you could turn it upside down. Say, well, why bother to do science then? And that's A, because I like it. I agree with that. But also because it provides you with legitimacy. Legitimacy is very important. And even the most prominent and world-famous scientists, when they lose their legitimacy as scientists, they also lose their legitimacy as social commentators. That certainly happened to Linus Pauling. when he stopped being a productive scientist and went off and talked about other things, mm-hmm. people stopped, they turned off their hearing aid. Mm-hmm. Because why should I listen to him? Mm-hmm. And look, I write a lot of public stuff. I write for the New York Review of Books. I write books about things related to science, but social things. And I've made a promise to myself, and I hope I can keep it. Mm-hmm. And that is that the day I stop doing any technical science of any kind, I'm going to quit writing anything. Mm-hmm. Because nothing is easier than to say, oh, well, that guy, you know, he can't be a scientist anymore. Mm-hmm. He's over the hill. Mm-hmm. And he just writes this stuff because he doesn't know what else to do. And therefore, it's useless. Mm-hmm. You must have legitimacy. Mm-hmm. And so my scientific work gives me that legitimacy.
Mm-hmm. And as I, in preparation for this interview, read some of your papers about politics and science and so on, I was struck that it seems to me, I'm not an expert on this, but your science informs the way you do your analysis. It's not the theory behind it, so to speak, but rather it helps you bring clarity to some of the issues. Because in a number of the papers that I looked at, you seem to be faulting both sides of
yeah,
the debate.
Look, I think that's you raise a very important point, Harry. A book which people don't know much anymore, which was very well known around the time of the Second World War, by a French sociologist and historian, Julien Benda, was called Le Trahison des Clercs, The Treason of the Intellectuals. And what Benda was saying is that intellectuals are supposed to be committed to a careful, logical, rational analysis, would commit treason against that in the interests of pushing a social agenda, even when that meant saying things that weren't true or claiming things were true that they didn't know to be true, or even things that to be true which they knew not to be true. Mm-hmm. An important difference, by the way. And that is uppermost in my mind all the time. For example, there's a struggle about so-called genetically manipulated organisms or GM foods and so on. Now, one might have a number of reasons for opposing that particular technology. To the extent that I oppose it, it has nothing to do with dangers to health and so on, of which there's no evidence. And yet I see people writing, mm-hmm. making claims which might support the public position I want to take on a political issue, mm-hmm. but using pseudo-scientific claims and their own legitimacy as scientists to tell what come to lies. I mean, I have to tell you, when I was thinking about the GM food thing, I read the works of a woman, Vandana Shiva, who is an extremely important writer in this field, who has a PhD in physics. So she's a scientist.
Yeah.
And one thing, I give you a specific example. One thing I read, Shiva said, do you realize that when children eat, infants eat baby food, they are getting 8 times the dose of estrogen that a woman gets when she takes her contraceptive pill? Mm-hmm. And I thought, my God, how terrible that a little baby will get 8 times the dose of estrogen that an adult woman gets when she takes a contraceptive pill. So I went to look at the paper she cited. Mm-hmm. Well, yes, it's true. They are getting 8 times the dose of a thing, but it turns out not to be physiologically active estrogen. It turns out to have only 1/1,000th of the physiological activity that estrogen has. It's a thing called a plant estrogen. And she played on the word estrogen. Mm-hmm. Now, she must have known the truth of the matter because she cited the paper from which she got the data.
Right.
But she would presumably regard that as a justifiable, I would call it a lie, she would say something else, in the interest of the greater good. And I think we cannot put up with that. Mm-hmm. Because in the end, it will be detected, it will make people cynical, and it will be counterproductive.
Mm-hmm. And in some ways, in the papers that I read, you bring out that it happens on all sides, basically.
Oh, yeah.
You did a review, I think, of the Shapiro Commission on bioethics, I think, and they, to deal with the political problem, not the science problem, you know, seem to legitimate some of the religious concerns, I think it was. In other words, there was an appendix to the report that was making part of the discussion something that really had no basis in science.
Well, not only that, you know, that was a political issue, but what's so interesting is they interviewed Catholic priests, Jewish rabbis, and some liberal Protestants. And when I questioned why they brought in those religious people, they said, well, after all, religion is a very important part of our society, and they made a perfectly reasonable explanation. So then I said, okay, then why didn't you bring in Pat Robertson? His constituency is a great deal larger than the constituency of the people you did. And they had no answer to that. The fact of the matter is they didn't want to bring in fundamentalist Christians. Mm-hmm. Because they would rock the boat too much. But if your real excuse is that you want to understand where people are coming from and you want an input from the public based on religion in order to make this political decision, then why are you avoiding the very people who are the most vocal, the most politically active, and who represent a large fraction of American religious people? So, and the answer is clear, that to bring in Pat Robertson was too dangerous. Mm-hmm. I mean, he would just upset the apple cart.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's pursue this, because I believe in the introduction to you, they pointed out that you joined the National Academy of Science in such and such a year, and then I believe they said you resigned from the Academy a few years later.
Yeah, it was about 3 years later.
Was that for scientific reasons, or was that in your role as social critic?
It was in the latter, but also, to put it even more stuffily, it had to do with personal integrity. All scientists in the United States want to be members of the National Academy. That's big stuff. So here I was elected to the National Academy. I felt wonderful. You know? Mm-hmm. And then I discovered that, among other things, the National Academy, through its operating arm, the National Research Council, had committees doing secret war research. Mm-hmm. It was so secret that not, as a member of the National Academy, which is the responsible body, as a member of that body, I was not only not allowed to know what they were doing, I wasn't even allowed to know the title of the research. So at the second meeting I went to, I guess, I got up and said, look, I can't be responsible for work other people are doing and not even know what it is. I think... you must stop this. And if you don't stop it, I have to resign from the Academy. I refuse to take responsibility. Well, of course, being a political organization, which is almost quasi-governmental, the National Academy Board was not about to refuse the Department of Defense and the military establishment. So they refused, so I left. Mm-hmm. But that was the proximal reason. The greater reason was that I realized at around that time, that the existence of a thing called the National Academy of Sciences, an honorary organization to which every scientist wants to aspire, is really destructive of intellectual life. That whole notion of the chief motivating element being prizes, honorary degrees, personal prestige, memberships in academies, that really turned me off. And, you know, that happened at a time when I was particularly politically active in the movements of the 60s and so on. And it was just a contradiction I couldn't deal with. Mm-hmm. So I had no choice but to resign.
Mm-hmm. Now, this leads to an interesting question, which is the role of government in science after World War II. You've written about this. And it in a way was central to fulfilling the requirements of society, To get around the problem that you were talking about earlier, namely that the kind of people you need to do science, the kind of capital investment you need, that really society has to be doing it. It has to be, those investments have to be socialized. But the private sector either couldn't or wouldn't do it, and one always had the problem that the result would then be privatized. So this is a kind of a recurring issue, and I just want you to help us understand how that process evolved, after World War II.
Well, it evolved largely through the efforts of Vannevar Bush, as a matter of fact. Mm-hmm.
Had been at Harvard, right? No,
I don't think Van Bush was ever at Harvard.
Okay.
He was at that time the head of the Carnegie Institution in Washington. He'd been very important in the war effort, in science and the war. And a report was written for the President of the United States called Science, the Endless Frontier, which put in a strong bid for government support of science, of which there had been virtually none before the Second World War. And it was the importance of science for national interest was underlined by the atomic bomb project and so on, radar. Everybody knew science. But private companies were not going to put money into science because they have very short investment horizons and it has to be privatized and so on. So what Van Bush pushed on the administration was the idea that there should be government support of science. On the other hand, the word socialism is a dirty word in the United States. Mm-hmm. So you couldn't socialize it. You had somehow to find a mechanism by which public money could be put into science, yet not appear to be some kind of a socialistic scheme. Mm-hmm. And what was developed was, at first, the National Science Foundation, which the first time around didn't get through Congress. Because Congress said, what do you mean, National Science Foundation? Am I, as a congressman, going to be able to have an input in what goes on here? Are you going to give away public money to these guys to do what they like? And it failed. Mm-hmm. But then under Truman, they finally succeeded, and they got the National Science Foundation created. And then the National Institutes of Health began to have a huge input into science. The Atomic Energy Commission, then called Office of Energy Development or something, and now it's the Department of Energy. They put a lot of money into science. Some of my earliest work was supported by what was then the AEC. Mm-hmm. It had nothing to do with atomic bombs, except mm-hmm. very, very vaguely. You know. And the way it worked was that Congress appropriated money for these institutions, but the decision about how the money was spent was left entirely in the hands of academics themselves. The NIH gets a budget, the NSF gets a budget, and then individual professors, scientists, are recruited into Washington onto committees, which meet three or four times a year, to review research proposals. And they say, yes, you shall have some, no, you shall not have some. So what has happened is that the scientific community as a whole has gained control over a piece of the public purse. Complete control, because it's we, I mean, I served on these committees for years, decide who gets the money and for what reason. The claim is, of course, that this is good for society in general. No one's ever proved that, and I'm not sure you could demonstrate that it benefited anybody in particular, but it really worked to the benefit, for example, of universities. A very large fraction of university budgets depend on this federal input into research, and especially after Sputnik, the budgets expanded exponentially. And the current state of university, including the University of California, Harvard, state universities of all kinds, private universities, the immense expansion in the higher education sphere, the immense expansion of the number of people who are in education, is all a consequence of the money put in by the federal government and given over to the academics to spend as they wish. Mm-hmm. It's a very extraordinary phenomenon.
And you suggest in one of your pieces that a vehicle for getting around the ideological hang-ups about doing this is the need to fight a war. And during the Cold War, it was really the
Soviet Union. War is the way you do it.
Yeah.
Scientists were given money to work during the Second World War because it was a war. Mm-hmm. Then there was the Cold War. Then there was a war on cancer. Mm-hmm. Then there was the war on the war on drugs. The rhetoric of war over and over and over again justifies the expenditure of public monies, which in our ideology is not to be done because that's socialism. So mm-hmm. war replaces socialism.
Mm-hmm. Now, it looked like there wasn't a war to fight after the end of the Cold War, but now we have the war on terrorism. Sorry, the war on terrorism. So the question is.
Oh yeah, but Harry, it's not. Yeah. It's not wars. War became a word that was separated from political wars. Mm-hmm. I say we had the war on cancer.
Right. Okay. All right.
The war on drugs.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Those did the trick.
Yeah.
We don't have to have the war on terrorism.
Okay. But we do have it.
We do have it.
Now, yeah. And what I'm curious about is, do you think that the particular threat posed, the use of biological weapons possibly by an adversary, do you think that will in any way skew the kinds of research that will be done? Or is there so much research going on that won't happen?
I don't see that it'll have any real effect on the research community. Look, Camp Dietrich and other institutions have been doing biological warfare research for years. They then shut it down because of various treaties and so on. They can always start it up again. The amount of money spent on that kind of stuff is pretty small as compared to the total budget of scientific research. So at the moment, I don't see that it'll have any effect, no. Mm-hmm. Now, the kind of effect such wars have, political wars like the war on terrorism, is to create a kind of security hysteria in which people may have to sign security, loyalty oaths, and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But as far as money is concerned, no, I don't see it.
And you actually believe that it often has not been in your particular, well, it has not been in your case that you were denied research funds because of your activities. In fact, it never happened.
Never happened.
That, in fact, that the kind of McCarthyite atmosphere that did exist in this Cold War period was really the work of politicians, people on boards of regents, and so on, who used it as an occasion for advantage or to go after people to succeed politically.
Yes, individuals certainly suffered. Yeah. I mean, there's no question about that.
Yeah.
People lost their jobs. People in the University of California, after the professors at the University of California swore loudly they'd never sign a loyalty oath, they did. Mm-hmm. They had no choice. But we don't live in a totalitarian society, and the system is very inefficient in that sense. And I and other people who were deeply involved in what were then regarded as, I suppose, subversive activities, continued to get funded without cessation from the Atomic Energy Commission, from the National Science Foundation, from the NIH, from the Office of Naval Research. The activities of McCarthy severely hurt some people and put a lot of psychological stress on others, but it was very inefficient as a way of denying mm-hmm. support to opponents of the state. Mm-hmm. Very inefficient. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, if we ever get as efficient enough to do that, we really will be living in a totalitarian state. So far, that hasn't happened.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that the profiling of students because of their national origins, which seems to be part of the agenda these days, how will that impact research if it's implemented?
It's very hard to know. Will they be denied entry into the university? Will you be prohibited from hiring them? I mean, I don't know the answer. Look, during the Second World War, Japanese were very severely hurt by that. Mm-hmm. Profiling. And curiously enough, German refugees who had left Germany either because of political or religious persecution nevertheless were German nationals and were restricted in their movement. My piano teacher, who taught at Curtis Institute in Philadelphia, had to get special permission to come up to New York to teach his students because he happened to be a German. He was a German Jew, and he left Germany. But yeah. So, yes, I mean, it does make people's lives difficult, and in some cases it makes real hardship. People lose their jobs. I mean, it's evil stuff. But to ask me whether it has a mass effect, mm-hmm. I haven't seen the mass effect yet, and I don't know what to tell you.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you were describing what you do as a scientist, one could see that the difficulty that the public might have in understanding, you know, what it is you do as a scientist. But in your writings, you're really saying that more is going on in the obfuscation of science that is a part of the landscape in the United States. And I want you to help us understand some of the social forces at work here. I think you're suggesting that some of it requires a kind of a political or sociological analysis of the community of scientists and how they fit in to national society and so on. I know that you've written a lot on the Human Genome Project and question both its goals and the way it's presented. Help us understand that problem a little.
Well, there are a lot of dimensions to it, Harry. Some of them are quite specific and some rather general. I don't know which to begin with. On the specific side, genetics in particular has for its entire history, since the beginning of the 20th century, except for a very brief period during the period of the Second World War, genetics has been extremely, what shall I call, deterministic in its view of the causes of human and social behavior. Geneticists have been, if you like, imperialistic in saying genes are responsible for everything. Mm-hmm. And the most violent eugenicists and in some ways racists were geneticists, who said genes dominate everything, and if there are differences between groups in how rich they are, how much power they have, it must be in the genes. Only for a short period, during the Second World War, when the consequences of that ideology in the National Socialist state in Germany became clear, did people back off that. Mm. When I was in high school during the Second World War, we got pamphlets saying, well, there really aren't any important differences between races and so on. But that disappeared when the war was over. And within 10 years of the end of the war, it had come back again. So biologists in general are biological determinists. Mm-hmm. And that has a very powerful ideological effect, because then they speak to reporters, they talk on the radio, they have TV interviews, and they push over and over again the determinism of the gene. My wife and I went yesterday to the Berkeley Art Museum, and there we saw an exhibit called Gene Genesis. Mm-hmm. And the poster for that exhibit, which is all over, has a quote from Jim Watson. Mm-hmm. And what does the quote say? It says, "We used to think our fate was in the stars, but now we know it's in our genes." Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, that's rubbish, you know. Mm-hmm. But that's what's pushed. And if you're a Nobel Prize winner like Jim, you get all the more credit for it. So scientists had that ideology that as organisms we are governed body and soul by our genes. Secondly, more broadly, scientists want to make claims for the importance of what they do in the general sense. So Jim Watson wants to say, look, you should support work on the genome, because after all, everything that's important in life is determined by genes. Mm-hmm. And that's not ideological, that's purely political. That is a crass way of trying to increase and guarantee the support of research. And the same is true for medical research. We're told over and over and over again that if we do this research, people's lives will be saved, people will be cured. Well, obviously, medical cures do arise out of some kinds of research. I mean, nobody can deny that. Mm-hmm. But promises are made of an extreme sort, which do not correspond to actual truth. I mean, this guy Hazeltine, who's the head of one of these private genome organizations, finally said what everybody wanted to say but didn't have the nerve to say. He said, death is nothing but a succession of preventable diseases. Well, if death is nothing but a succession of preventable diseases, mm-hmm. then if you give us enough money, you'll live forever. Mm-hmm. Now, no sensible person believes that. But that's the kind of appeal that it's made. Give us more power, give us more money, and we will not postpone your death. We will prevent it. Mm-hmm. Look, there are a lot of sick people in the world. Most of them are sick ultimately because they're underfed and overworked. Mm-hmm. That's not the case for Americans. Most Americans are sick because of, they've lived a long time and their machines are breaking mm-hmm. down. You know, the transmission goes and then the you need a brake job and so on. Mm-hmm. And there's a tremendous public demand and people are in pain. You know? Mm-hmm. And there's a demand to relieve that pain and relieve that anxiety. And science cashes in on that in, I think, a very cynical way by making promises that can't be kept. Mm-hmm.
And another way it does this, you were suggesting in your lectures, is by the metaphors it uses.
Well, that's how you do it, of course. You do it by saying genes make the organism. Mm-hmm. And if you really believe it, genes are self-replicating, so they are powerful. They have, mm-hmm. The whole notion is that the genes inside of us are sort of independent of us. They're in there doing their work. Mm-hmm. They make new copies of themselves, and they make you, and therefore they make society. And so if you support research on them, mm-hmm. you will be able to change everything you want to change. Mm-hmm. And the metaphors are that genes make proteins, that genes are self-replicating, and so on and so forth.
Sure. Which leads, as you were suggesting in your lecture, an ignoring of the relationship of the organism to its environment.
Exactly so. Yeah, yeah. Exactly so. Because the minute you allow the complication of the interaction between the gene and the environment, then it doesn't look like genes are quite so important as mm-hmm. as before. Mm-hmm. Then you have to say, well, look, let's take the case of the major killers of the 19th and 20th centuries. The major killers of the 19th and 20th centuries, up until the first decade or so of the 20th century, were certain infectious diseases. That's what killed people. Those infectious diseases were not waterborne diseases. They were airborne diseases. And a major killer of children in the 19th century was measles. Now think of that. When I was a child, everybody had measles. Everybody in my class had measles. Nobody died of it. But in the 19th century, children died of measles. The major killer of women in the 19th century was not women of childbearing age was not childbearing. It was tuberculosis. Now, why is it that tuberculosis was the major killer of people in the 19th century? The germs are still around and is now a very small fraction of the death rate. And very few people get tuberculosis now. People do, but very few relative to the population at large. And children don't die of measles. Well, now, of course, they're inoculated against measles, but nobody in my generation died of measles, although measles is still a primary cause of child mortality in West Africa. The reason is because both tuberculosis and measles are, in their severity and eventual effect, and probably of getting tuberculosis, are closely related to nutrition. Measles is a protein-consuming disease, and if you already have a severe protein deficit, as children in West Africa do, and then you get the measles, you die. If you're well-fed, and measles does something, measles actually destroys protein, it consumes protein. So, you know, if you're already underfed, you're in big trouble if you get measles. But if you're well-fed as I was, and as my classmates in school were, then it's just an annoyance. Tuberculosis was the chief killer during the 19th century because people were underfed. And women died more of tuberculosis than men because in 19th century industrial England, for example, where the data come from, men were better fed than women. When there was meat to be had and the man came home from the factory, the man got the meat and the women and children got what was left over. So as far as death, the causes of death are concerned in our society, environment, social environment, pay scales, unemployment, social attitudes toward who deserves to get fed and who doesn't, have had a profound effect on the causes of mortality.
So you're suggesting that the metaphors that we choose are in part the result of the political and social dynamics within science.
Absolutely.
You know, the competition for resources and power, but that also that they reflect the broader society and the decisions about, for example, the individual versus the community or whatever dichotomies we might be talking about.
Yes, quite so. I mean, you don't want to think that the chief cause of death in your society is that people are underfed.
Right.
That's bad news. Mm-hmm. Because then people might demand that you do something about it. Instead of putting all that money into germs, you should put it into feeding people.
Mm-hmm. So then what is then the answer for the problem that you posed in your writings, namely the problem of the inadequate way the public understands what science is up to and the lack of tools to criticize
that? That's a very serious problem, Harry, that I don't have a good answer to. Science reporting in newspapers, for example, and on the radio and on TV are a serious problem. They're a serious problem not because science reporters are dumb or ignorant. It's because of the nature of public media. I know a lot of science reporters. I work together, I have over the years, with the Knight Journalism Fellowships at MIT, where science journalists come to MIT and spend a year on sabbatical or 6 months on sabbatical interacting with scientists, and I have met with them often. And I've been greatly impressed with how much they know. But when it's time to write an article for the New York Times, mm-hmm. or have 5 minutes on TV or on the radio, you are in competition with all kinds of other people who want column inches and 5 minutes on the radio. And if you don't make it dramatic, you don't get the 5 minutes. I mean, you cannot get a long column in the science-ish part of the New York Times or the news part of the New York Times if you write an article saying, well, it's all very complicated. You know, it's some of this and some of that, and we really don't know what's happening, and we're sort of trying to find out, and it's probably some environment. No editor is going to give you column inches for that. Mm-hmm. That's point one. And the result is that much of what's written for the public is obfuscating because it's overdramatic. Scientists today have found a gene which, and then you read what they say, which may one day give us information that might lead to a cure for. Now, it's always may one day, might lead to. Mm-hmm. But that slips under the rug. The important thing is scientists announced today that. And of course, a great deal of what appears in the press and on the radio and on TV about the products of science are the outcome of press conferences called by the press office of the University of X, which is constantly after its professors to feed them stuff which they can then announce to the press. And then the press guy goes to the press conference, and somebody gets up and says, "Today we found a gene for," and so on. That's another way of getting money, of bringing, you know, if I have to deal with the state legislature and getting my budget, one of the things I'd like to do is to say people on my faculty have contributed this, that, and the other to public welfare, and if you don't believe it, look in the Los Angeles Times for last week.
Mm-hmm.
So there are strong social pressures on scientists to make excessive claims, and there are strong pressures on those who report science to the public to exaggerate and simplify. Not just, and look, I'm all in favor of simplifying. If a thing can be made simple, let's make it simple.
Mm-hmm.
But they simplify it to the extent of making it untrue, and that's the real problem.
Mm-hmm. Or simplify to the extent of furthering the interests of particular groups or companies or whatever.
To some extent, although I don't think that's the most serious issue.
Yeah.
The most serious issue is just going along with the metaphors and extreme inaccurate simplifications of the field just in order to be able to get it out there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see most science journalists as either witting or unwitting tools of commercial interest. There may be such mm-hmm. people, but that's not our big problem.
It's a broader landscape. The way it all hangs together,
yeah.
So to speak.
Look, I have the experience of reading the science section of the New York Times once a week, the Science Times, and not understanding what the reporters are telling me. I'm a scientist, and I'm not just a biologist. I'm also a statistician. I was trained in physics as an undergraduate. I mean, I'm a pretty broad, I'm not an expert in nuclear physics, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. But I try to understand what the reporter is telling me, and I can't ever understand it.
And why is that, do you think?
Because it doesn't have the kind of logical, detailed development that I expect. You know, A leads to B, B leads to C, C leads to D. No. A was discovered, and that means D. And I can't figure out the relationship between them at all.
Mm-hmm. If students were to watch this tape and they aspire to wear the both hats that you have worn very well, that of a critic of both science and a commentator on society in general, but also that of a scientist. What are there some rules that we can lay down for how one does that well without compromising?
Yeah, well, rule one, Harry, is don't start out by being a social critic. Mm-hmm. Start out by being a scientist, because I think I said in this interview before, but I'll say it again if I haven't, that the critical issue for a social critic is legitimacy. And you don't want to be written off as some sort of loudmouth who can't do anything better than just yak. Mm-hmm. So the first thing to do is to establish real credentials as a producer of science, recognized by the science community and accepted by them as being of some value. When you stand on that base, you can then go out. Mm-hmm. The second point is that you must make it clear at all times, and it must be clear in your own mind, that the science that you do and the result, and especially not the science you do, but the results you get in your science and what you say about science cannot be shown to be simply the consequence of your social attitudes. If I say that genes and environment are important, I have to have a firm underpinning for that within the scientific apparatus. I cannot say, well, I wish that were true because I would like a world in which I could change the world, and therefore I'm prejudiced in the way I report the world. Because that's the first thing that your opponents will say. Oh, you just say that because that's your political ideology. You're justifying that political ideology by pretending that science has done that. The observations have to be there independent of any justification. You have to distinguish between why you do a thing and what the result is. It may be that you are propelled forward to study the relationship between gene and environment because you have some political agenda. But what you say better not be tainted by that. Mm-hmm. That's very tricky and very important.
And what is your advice to the general public? Because I can hear people watching this say, well, if he can't understand what's being said in the New York Times science section, you know, how can I understand? So what can people, the average person, do to be informed citizens in the debates that involve science, policies that are rationalized about science through the uses of science?
Harry, you raised there one of the most difficult social problems that exists. And I want to put it in a broader context for a moment before I come back to the specific question you're asking, because I don't know the answer to the specific question. The founding fathers of our republic said that essentially that you can't have a democratic society if you don't have an educated electorate. How can people make democratic decisions about what has to be done unless they have some education? So we have a public education system. What the founding fathers never could have imagined is the kind of knowledge that you would have to have in order to make informed decisions. Look, let's talk about the Star Wars project. I don't know enough about physics and engineering to decide whether it would work or not. I have to trust somebody else to tell me. I don't know enough about physics to make those decisions. I have to trust what Steve Weinberg tells me. Okay? Mm-hmm. Now, that is a very serious problem. I'm a scientist, and I still have to trust what other people tell me. So the problem for the public in general is that in order to make democratic decisions, you have to believe something about elite knowledge, which is possessed only by a few people. Mm-hmm. And it's very hard to know what to do about that. It really, I don't have a glib answer to that. It is one of the contradictions of a democratic society in a highly advanced technological world, that to make rational political decisions, you have to have a knowledge which is accessible only to a very few people. And the first rule, I suppose, is if there are public disagreements among people who are supposedly equally expert, then you better be careful. I mean, if they all agree, well, you have no choice but to take what they say. I don't know what else you can do. Mm-hmm. But if there's any disagreement, then listen carefully to what those debates are about and see if you can figure out who's coming from where and why. That's true for the Genome Project and things like that. That's what killed Star Wars. Well, I don't know that's what killed Star Wars, but that's what made the public doubtful about it. Whether that was had any effect politically, I don't know the answer. But I have no answer to the question, mm-hmm. because there are no institutions of promoting the public understanding of science that are widely available to the public that do not obfuscate the issues either by funneling them through media people who have to try to get the space in your before your eyes and in your ears, and therefore they're under control of editorial exigencies and so on, or because they're the captives of scientists who have their own agendas, so that the head of the Whitehead Institute will tell them how wonderful everything they do is because that's part of the agenda. I don't know the answer. I don't have an answer. I think the answer is listen to me.
Or at least we have to find out a way to how to institutionalize you. You said something which this will be the last question and maybe a brief answer. You really believe that. I think you said two things that I just, if you want to comment. You said men make their own history, but not as they choose.
I didn't invent that.
No, I know you. Yeah, no, I know. But it tells us where you are philosophically in your view of human nature. And then you also said to decide, it was a responsibility to decide what kind of world you want and make the decisions to move in that direction.
If you can.
If you can, yeah.
And that's the problem, because the latter one, yes, but the context I said them in are important. You can't make the world stay still. It's going to evolve. Species are going to become extinct. The world is going to change. Technology is going to change. Nature is going to change. Nature is changing all the time. And so if we're going to concentrate on influencing things, we should not try to concentrate on holding them the way they are, because that's hopeless. Mm-hmm. What we should do, in fact, is to try to concentrate on changing them in a direction that we find better. The only trouble is that we is a heterogeneous collection, mm-hmm. which includes people with very different interests. Mm-hmm. I'm a citizen of the state of Vermont, and my fellow townspeople have bumper stickers on their cars that say, "Another Vermonter for global warming." Because if you lived in Vermont, you'd like it to be warmer. You know, people who own stock in companies that make air conditioning machines might be in favor of global warming. That's, in a sense, trivializing the point, which is that different people have different interests. And therefore, the struggle is not a moral one, or it's a political one. It's always a political one. And that's the most important thing you have to recognize, that you may be struggling to make the world go in one direction, somebody else is struggling to make it go in another direction, and the question is, who has power? And if there's a differential in power, and you haven't got it and they have, then you have to do something to gain power, which is to organize. And I guess my final order is organize, organize, organize.
And on that note, Professor Lewinson, thank you very much for taking the time from your schedule to be here today.
Thank you, Harry, for talking to me.
Thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.